7.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Osama bin Laden is back on the radar. The recent capture of al-Qaeda's number three man, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in Pakistan, opened up a treasure trove of leads, some of which appear to be opening up new directions in the investigation of al-Qaeda operations worldwide, and even in the search for Osama bin Laden. Excited speculation about the timing of the al-Qaeda leader's capture, though, was doused by disputed reports that two of Osama bin Laden's sons had been apprehended late last week, and a new round of CIA warnings about possible attacks in the West or on U.S. soldiers on the Iraqi border further dulled the sheen of the promising news that came late last week. It also raises difficult questions about just how significant Osama bin Laden's capture is at this point in history, when al-Qaeda cells seem able to operate on their own instructions, and when geopolitical tensions from Iraq to North Korea vie for America's attention. Well, Connection listeners, how important is it to you, to this country, to find Osama bin Laden? Would his capture be a real or a symbolic victory in the war on terror? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll start today with two reporters who've been covering the hunt for al-Qaeda. Shakir Hussain is in Karachi, Pakistan. He writes for both the Dawn Group of newspapers and for the Business Recorder. And Scott Baldoff is also with us. He's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. He's in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Scott, let me start with you if I can, because I understand that you've come recently from a briefing of Pakistani's security agency.
Yes, that's correct. We were just given a first ever briefing by the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, which is the military intelligence arm of Pakistan's army, in which they gave some of the details of the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the number three man underneath Osama bin Laden within al-Qaeda. They gave details of the arrest, how some of the information was given to them, what is their level of cooperation with U.S. agencies, and where all this is going to lead. It was also an attempt to try and soften up the Western media. There's a perception that the Western media are fairly critical of Pakistan and its role in the war on terrorism, and the perception that maybe they're playing a double role.
And what was said about the cooperation between the United States and Pakistani forces? Because that appears to be the source of some considerable contradiction between what we hear from American sources and then denials that we've been hearing from Pakistani politicians.
Well, it's a very dicey subject, of course, here in Pakistan. In a country where there is a great deal of concern about sovereignty, there are religious parties, for instance, which have gained power in two states just on this very issue of trying to get American troops out of Pakistan. So Pakistani officials have been very strong on the point that American troops or American law enforcement people, American agents were not involved in the actual arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But they do say that America did provide technical assistance, for instance, the wiretaps and a lot of the computer data that led to the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They admit that that did occur. That may explain why there is some contradiction.
Shakir Hussain, why are the Pakistani forces so reluctant to talk about the way that they work with their American counterparts?
Well, obviously, you've got the domestic pressure in our internal politics, where a lot of people sort of view this as an infringement on the sovereignty of Pakistan, as we were just told. And basically, they want to downplay any U.S. role. And I think what's happening in the Middle East right now, sensitivities are extremely high, and they just basically want to get the job done and, I think, get it over and done with. That's essentially the way the security forces are looking at it.
And Shakir, what's the latest information that you're hearing there about the search for Osama bin Laden? Are you hearing information that's sketchy or What have you got?
It's all very sketchy, but I'd like to add that I'm actually, right now I'm in the commercial capital of Pakistan, and basically in Pakistan right now, the real issue on everyone's mind is what's happening in Iraq or what's going to happen in the coming weeks. And that's more of a concern for the average person than the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Is Osama bin Laden then not as much a figure of, what would I say, admiration or defiance as was reported a year, 6 months ago?
I think it's not a question of admiration, really. It's more a question of immediate concern because the events that are happening in Iraq currently, there is a lot of public perception that Pakistan can't be far off. I'm just looking at the new sort of issue of Herald, which is a monthly magazine here, and it's, the title is The Domino Effect, What Does a War in Iraq Mean for Pakistan? And frankly, that's a question a lot of Pakistanis are asking and are wondering as to what's going to happen. So, yes, Iraq is more of a concern than Osama bin Laden. Yeah.
Scott Baldoff, tell me how you see this sort of division of views, because you'll know, working for the Christian Science Monitor, that you know the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and then the speculation about Osama bin Laden was pretty big news last week.
Oh, it was huge news, and of course there have been a number of events that have followed after that. Other operations in different parts of here in Pakistan, but also in Afghanistan. It's clear that there is a step up in activity. Whether or not, of course, this leads from the actual investigation or whether these things were separate, it's hard to know. But of course that's something that the American readers are very interested in. Is of course Osama bin Laden. They want to know whether they would like to see some closure, obviously, on this issue. I would only add actually that there is a concern here that with Iraq brewing in the Gulf, with that war appearing to be inevitable at this stage, there's some concern that that a precedent is being set and that there may be very little to stop a similar action in another country. And some people here in Pakistan actually worry that it could happen here too.
Now, we'll get back to Iraq. That part of the conversation is inevitable. But Scott, just a little bit more from you, if I can get the reporter's perspective on what it's like trying to cover the story of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Because when I try to read a bunch of different reports here in the United States, the geography is all conflicting. The information is contradictory. How can you manage there?
Well, imagine trying to buy a plane ticket to the place where he's thought to be hiding. One day it appears that he's up in the north, you know, in the northeast, the northeast, around Chitral. Before that, it's down in the southwest, along the border with Afghanistan. And sometimes people are looking in Waziristan. And all of these, of course, are brand new places to most reporters here. So trying to figure out where to go next or where to locate yourself to be close to it is virtually impossible. The other problem is sourcing. You know, most of the sources for these stories tend to be unnamed officials belonging to either the Pakistani intelligence or American intelligence, and who knows what agendas are being are in act there.
Shakir Hussain, what's your view on speculation that Osama bin Laden is not even alive anymore, that the search is simply chasing ghosts, that Osama bin Laden was killed perhaps a year ago?
Well, again, I mean, my focus and what I've been saying all along is I don't think the person is as important. I think it's more important to the U.S., obviously, symbolically and sort of, you know, in other terms. But in terms of the reality on the ground, I think it's much sort of more prudent to be going after the real assets, the people on the ground, rather than sort of be chasing as a ghost, as you call it. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, the recent capture of this the number three gentleman is sort of operationally, it's sort of has more effect than, say, catching bin Laden himself, except for, of course, the symbolism of the whole thing.
I'm just trying to get an understanding from you, Shakir, about how easy it is to keep a secret, for example, in Afghanistan or Pakistan. I mean, there's $25 million on this man's head. Are there people that think they know where he is, or is it all just chatter?
No, I think it's a lot of it is chatter, and there's so much chatter, in fact, that I think it's the $25 million sure sort of, you know, add to that chatter. And, you know, as in the previously, you've had the same cases, but in this one, this is the big kahuna, as the Americans would like to call it, and sort of everyone wants a piece of it. And I think for U.S. intelligence and Pakistani intelligence to actually cut, you know, the fat from all this chatter is going to be extremely difficult.
And Scott Baldoff, tell me what your view is of the question that we're asking our listeners this hour, and that is whether or not the capture or the possible likely capture of Osama bin Laden, use whatever adjective you want, is in these days, at this moment, something that is very real and very important in the war on terror, or something that's more symbolic?
Well, as you say, the symbolism is very important. The capture of Osama bin Laden, particularly the live capture of Osama bin Laden, would be a huge break, obviously, for the Americans, for the Pakistanis as well, for anyone who signs on to the war on terrorism. If he would be killed, there is a possibility, of course, that he could be turned into a martyr, which would be a rallying cause for extremists, you know, to go to the cause. And remember, one of the big problems here is that even if Osama is captured or killed, even if most of the top echelon of leaders are killed, there will still be plenty of people in this part of the world who believe that the West is an enemy, and that violence is a method that is appropriate against that enemy.
So give me your take on what Shakir was saying earlier, Scott, about the fact that most people in Pakistan are way more concerned with what's about to happen in Iraq. When you go to the markets in a place like Peshawar or Rawalpindi or all the different places that you've been recently, do you see the T-shirts and the posters, the praise of bin Laden that was so prevalent a year ago?
Well, interestingly, not here in Islamabad or Rawalpindi so much. There was a huge rally, however, in Rawalpindi, which is the neighboring city to the capital.
Right.
Several hundred thousand people. The organizers claimed a million. They called it a million-man march. But it was all in, you know, it was all against the war in Iraq, and there is, of course, an overlap in support for if not Al Qaeda, then at least the Taliban, and at least in the similar causes this man espouses. But in Karachi, for instance, you can buy a box of candies with Osama bin Laden's face on it. You can buy a doll with Osama's figure riding around in a jeep. Presumably eluding U.S. officials. So he is a kind of a figure in a certain segment of society, but I would have to say that's a minority.
All right, Scott, stay with us if you can. I'll take this opportunity to thank Shakir Hussain for being with us. Shakir, thanks again.
No problem.
Shakir is an independent reporter and columnist based in Karachi, writing for the Dawn Group of Newspapers and the Business Recorder. And Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we'll be talking also with Paul Wilkinson, director and chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University. Our topic this hour, the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and as Scott just said, the overlap in that area for the support for bin Laden, for Al Qaeda, for the Taliban, and how it's playing out in the place where bin Laden is being sought. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For more on the search for Osama bin Laden, go to our website.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, just 10 days ago, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was pulled from his bed in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, and the computer files and floppy disks and cell phone records that were gathered from the house where he'd been staying have dramatically changed the hunt for Al-Qaeda operatives around the world. In particular, there was talk last week that perhaps special forces soldiers were closer to Osama bin Laden than they'd been in a year's time. And this hour of conversation about the hunt for bin Laden, the hunt for al-Qaeda operatives in light of everything else that's going on this week. We're joined on the phone from St. Andrews University in Scotland by Paul Wilkinson. He's director and chairman of the Centre for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence there. Hello, Paul.
Hello there.
Paul, you had a chance to listen into what Scott and some of what Shakir was saying, and what you may have missed at the beginning is Shakir saying, you know, that the whole bin Laden thing's really not much of a news story in Pakistan. People are so focused on Iraq. Scott, of course, filing for the Christian Science Monitor, says it's a huge story and getting a considerable amount of attention on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. I'd like your perspective on those two divergent views, if you could start there.
Well, I think it's understandable that at the moment the big story in a Muslim country is the possibility of a military attack on Iraq. This is something which obviously concerns the Muslim world as a whole. And one of the things I think we need to be concerned about is that you know, whether you are in favor of a military invasion of Iraq or not, one has to bear in mind that it will have an effect on the coalition partners, especially the Muslim partners, because the assistance they have been given to the coalition is absolutely vital. We can see how important it is, for example, in the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You need maximum support from the Muslim countries in the coalition, and it's going to be more difficult for them to maintain stability and to maintain their help for the coalition if there is an attack on Iraq. It's just a fact of life, because they see that as an attack on fellow Muslims. And, of course, bin Laden and his henchmen will exploit any such attack as a propaganda weapon.
What's your supposition, Paul, then, that if, in fact, the attack on Iraq goes ahead, that the cooperation that we now know exists between American soldiers and Pakistani and Afghan soldiers will simply go further underground, or that it may, in fact, break off?
I think it'll be more difficult in that there will be far more protest from the extreme groups that sympathize with bin Laden, and there will be a bigger job to do for the security forces, for example, in Pakistan, maintaining stability and ensuring that attempts to unseat the government fail. I think there will be some attempts to try to destabilize the government in Pakistan. And this may well occur in other countries. It is an area where there are many countries with rather fragile political systems, and clearly there is a danger that they will be subjected to so much protest and instability as a result of a war in Iraq that it will not be practical for them to continue with considerable help to the battle against al-Qaeda.
Let me, if I can, Paul, just turn to Scott Baldoff there, because as you may have heard, Scott was just earlier today at a briefing of the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, Pakistani military intelligence. Scott, did you get a sense of what Paul's describing, that it may get very uncomfortable for countries like Pakistan to continue working with Americans in the war on terror?
Well, absolutely right. One of the big concerns that the ISI themselves admitted was that they have to go very slowly about any sort of investigation, because they recognize that a certain segment of their own society, including people within their own military and within their own intelligence service, may reflect the overall majority opinion, which is that an Islamic pure Islamic state, such as the Taliban claim they were creating, is something that's very widely accepted and actually approved of. So to proceed in a war on the violent side of that sometimes means that you're going to be creating divisions with your own intelligence network, and you could have substantial resistance there.
All right, Connection listeners, with me on the program today, Scott Baldoff, Christian Science Monitor correspondent who's been working in Afghanistan. He's currently in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad. And Paul Wilkinson, who's director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism at St. Andrews University. And we're talking about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Paul, I said to, or rather asked Scott a bit earlier in the program, and I'd like to hear from you on our question for listeners this hour. And that is the impact of capturing someone like bin Laden now at this point something that's more symbolic than real?
I think that it would be an enormous blow against al-Qaeda because he is, in their eyes, a charismatic leader. He's a man who's seen as a hero, who stood up for a particular view of Islam, which has a following. As Scott has pointed out, it is only a minority following in the Muslim world, but it's a very strident, fanatical minority. And it has a global network of supporters and sympathizers. And we shouldn't forget that that network is still capable of terrorist attacks, and it's still going to remain capable of attacks, even if bin Laden is captured or killed.
But does the threat change? Does the organization al-Qaeda lose something if bin Laden is caught?
I think it undoubtedly would lose something. It would be a major psychological blow, and undoubtedly bin Laden's qualities as a leader of this kind of extremism are quite unusual. I don't think it would be easy to replace him in that sense. However, I'm sure that they have already got a succession plan worked out if bin Laden is killed or captured. And it's interesting that they have replaced all the senior people, or the more senior people, who have been captured or killed since the beginning of the war on terrorism. So we shouldn't underestimate their ability to adapt as an organization, and we shouldn't relax our guard because they still remain the most dangerous international terrorist network we've ever seen in the history of international terrorism.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take our first call from Melrose, Massachusetts. Jacqueline's joining us. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, thank you. Aren't there going to be just a tremendous and frightening number of terrorists erupting after we, if we actually invade Iraq, since there are terrorists, the president said, in 68 countries? That means there are thousands of them around the world. And right after 9/11, the Muslims in America said one of the reasons is our policy toward Israel and toward Iraq. Even then, isn't it going to be just a terrible situation if we actually kill innocent Muslims?
Jacqueline, let's hear from both our guests on that, because it's certainly something that comes up a lot in a conversation about the possibility of an attack on Iraq. Scott Baldoff, why don't you start? The notion or the fear that an attack that is seen to be unprovoked on Iraq will spawn a whole new generation of bin Ladens.
Well, this is something that that we definitely see. Although, frankly, here in Pakistan, a lot of the people who have been showing up to protests are very familiar faces from the protests back at the beginning of the air war, after September 11th in October of 2001. There are similar sized crowds out in the streets of Peshawar and so on, most of whom were already of that mindset. Whether or not there could be a new generation created is a definite possibility, because of course there is a network that transfers this mindset through religious seminaries, through sermons at mosques, but also just frankly through intellectual society. There is a segment of society in the middle class of almost any Islamic country in which the American predominance in the world affairs is something that is not seen as a positive thing, even if they may not agree with violence.
Paul, let me hear from you, because if we go back to, and these are the areas that you study, if we go back to the early 90s when Osama bin Laden was first starting up those camps in Afghanistan, we could say that, you know, it took 10 years to organize what happened on September 11th, and yet there's that fear that if there's an attack on Iraq, there's going to be some kind of immediate terrorist reaction. How do we see this in, or how should we be seeing this in terms of timelines?
Well, of course, you're right. It has been the case that Al-Qaeda thinks long-term. They have planned many of their outrages years in advance, not just months in advance. And, of course, it is a network that is still in being. And as I stressed a moment ago, we shouldn't underestimate the capacity of that network to launch terrorist attacks. I think that there's a dual problem arising if we go to war in Iraq. One is that that network will have clear instructions to maximize terrorist violence against the United States, Britain, and other allied targets. And, of course, it's also true that they will get more recruits. More money will be paid into their coffers through so-called charities, through wealthy donors in the Gulf area and elsewhere. And I think we have to take into account that bin Laden is already exploiting the prospect of a war with Iraq as a great propaganda weapon. Remember the audio tape that was issued only a matter of days ago, publicized only days ago, in which he called upon all Muslims to carry out attacks against American targets whenever and wherever possible. I think this was predictable. It doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda thinks that Saddam is a wonderful regime and worth protecting. In fact, they condemned him as an infidel and as a non-Islamic leader. What it means is that they see any attack on a Muslim state as an attack which has to be answered by holy war, and they will use this to try and escalate the holy war. Now, your comments from Scott and from your listeners are concerned about numbers. I can understand that concern. Of course, we tend to think in numbers when we think of conventional warfare, but we have to remember it doesn't take very many fanatics to carry out the most terrible terrorist attacks. Look at the number of people actually involved in the suicide hijackings on 9/11. You have to have small, dedicated, expert teams prepared to commit suicide in the course of their holy war. And I'm sorry to say that there are such groups available. More are probably being prepared as we talk for attacks against American and other Western targets. And therefore, it is realistic to assume that we will get more terrorist attacks as a result of a war in Iraq, not necessarily concentrated in the period of military operations, which, given the superiority of American forces, will probably be quite brief. But in the longer term, we have to think that, you know, we have to think beyond a war to the consequences of a war. And I think one of the things we must take account of is that bin Laden and his extremist allies will take this as a great propaganda opportunity, and it will act as a recruiting sergeant for more terrorists. And one further point, of course, we have to remember that in addition to the cells and support networks that are established over some period of time, there are sympathizers, freelancers, if we can call them that, who pick up the bin Laden-type ideology on the Internet and can use the Internet to find out how to make chemical weapons, how to carry out attacks, how to use poisons. And unfortunately, this kind of information is so readily available that one of the problems our intelligence services and police services now face is that in addition to the Al-Qaeda structures and the affiliated organizations, you have this unknown area of the freelancer, the supporter, the sympathizer, who is not perhaps a formal member of an organization, but who could nevertheless carry out terrorist attacks doing terrible damage. So,
all right, let me just step in there if I can. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Jacqueline, thanks a lot for that call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jeremiah is with us now. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I just think when everybody's talking about we need to be aware of the dangers of going to war with the terrorists and that there's going to be more terrorist attacks, I think there's going to be more terrorist attacks no matter what we do. Because the first one that happened, you know, 9/11, we weren't at war with anybody. And the thing is, now that we're on the attack, there's less things happening. All that's happening is we're catching terrorists and stopping them. And I'm not saying that there won't ever be more terrorist attacks, because I'm sure there will be. But I think we're already on the attack and we're stopping them, because their resources aren't, I mean, they have a lot of money and all, but their overall resources aren't that good. And so, I think being on the attack is going to stop them.
So, Jeremiah, just to go back to where we began the program in talking about Osama bin Laden, are you saying that it's every bit as important now for the United States and other countries to keep up the pressure on al-Qaeda, and particularly on trying to track down Osama bin Laden?
Yes. I mean, I think making a big deal about Osama bin Laden might not be as worthwhile as it, you know, as it sounds, you know, about him individually. But I do think it's important that we stay on the attack. I mean, because it's a, you know, it's a known fact. I mean, even in business or in war, you never win by being on the defense. And if we just wait around to try to stop terrorists from, you know, when they're attacking, or hope that they won't attack anymore, I mean, that's what we were doing in the first place.
I agree with that, Jeremiah. I think you have to be constantly aware of the need to be proactive, to go after them before they can actually launch attacks against civilians around the world. But I think we have to remember that if we devote a great deal of attention, military forces, expertise, and money to a campaign in Iraq, there will not be as much attention and resources and military and intelligence capability left to deal with the rest of the world, where terrorism is still an ongoing problem.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jeremiah, thanks for that call. And we'll continue the conversation when we come back. We'd like to hear from you. What would the capture of Osama bin Laden mean to you? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the 10 o'clock news on WB56.
See you there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. And with us on the program this hour, Scott Baldoff, Christian Science Monitor correspondent. He is in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad. Paul Wilkinson is with us. He is director and chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University. And we're revisiting the hunt for Osama bin Laden after a week of fairly fevered speculation coming on the heels of the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the number three al-Qaeda person, reputed number three person who was picked up in Rawalpindi. And Paul, I thought I'd start just by getting a sense from you of how, in your view, the investigation changed with his arrest, because we have to make do with second, third, and fourth hand reports about what was found in a laptop computer and what can be traced in cell phone records. But how much do you think that arrest has changed the worldwide investigation of al-Qaeda?
Well, before I answer that, can I just make two points about the previous conversation we had?
Yeah.
One is that I think we shouldn't confuse challenge of Saddam and his efforts to secure weapons of mass destruction and the problem of al-Qaeda, because they are really rather separate problems. I think it's clear that al-Qaeda has some tenuous linkage with Iraq, but its main links are with other countries, as we know, and their global network could go on committing terrorist attacks whatever happens to Iraq in the conflict. So let's not confuse the two things.
All right.
And the second point I wanted to make is that Afghanistan is still a very fragile system as far as the battle against terrorism is concerned. There is evidence of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban people moving back across the border from the tribal areas of Pakistan and beginning to entrench themselves in Afghanistan again. That is a great challenge to the interim government, which has problems enough on its plate already. And I think it is a reminder also that military efforts alone are not going to be enough to defeat Al-Qaeda. We need very high quality of intelligence to find out where these people are hiding, to pick them up and capture them before they can do any more damage.
Paul, let me just stop you there if I can, because Scott has been traveling recently in Afghanistan. And Scott, maybe you can help a little bit in terms of how you're seeing the mood, the attitude of people in Afghanistan with what Paul's describing as a sort of real fragile sense of who's in control and a shift back from some of the people who might have been Taliban, might be Al-Qaeda.
Well, there are provinces in Afghanistan that, but for the change of a hat or a turban, are essentially the same places they were before the Taliban fell. Many of the same leaders have actually changed. They just owe their allegiance by lip service to the central government of President Karzai. So if there were a change, if there were an influx of some of their former fellow fighters of the Taliban, and if there was a perception that the Americans could be challenged, or that the American presence and the Afghan central government could be challenged, there's a possibility, every possibility, that they would switch sides and bring with them a good number of local fighters who until then had been Americans, America's friends. And that is particularly true down in along the Afghan-Pakistani border, particularly in the south and southwest, around Kandahar and Helmand province. And some of that has actually very little to do with religion. Some of it has to do with old businesses like opium smuggling. There are people who have vested interests that are more economic rather than political or even Islamic that lead them to want to oppose the current government. So some of these factors are going to be very difficult to change, and it's not just as simple as routing out some very high-level Arab terrorist networks.
Cash, not ideology. Why should we not be surprised? And, Paul, I'll get a chance to get back to you with my question about the clues and the change in the investigation, but we do have a number of people on the phones, and so let me bring some of them in to Lee, who's calling in now from Anong, Wisconsin. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted, you know, I'm kind of looking at the situation. If we catch Bin Laden, that's all it's going to be is a political victory. I mean, kind of technically, because even if we do catch him, you know, he can be sitting in a prison and he'll still be able to run part of Al-Qaeda through prison.
You think so?
Oh, well, I mean, he's going to be able to send letters. He's going to be able to do stuff. Well, we can't stop him from doing that, because technically that would be against our, you know, our rights in the United States, and we have to give that to him. So he could sit in prison and write a letter. I guess it's just a political thought. Everything still can happen if we arrest him. It's all of Al-Qaeda. It's everybody that is involved with terrorists that we have to worry about, not just Osama bin Laden.
I think you're right on the last part there, but Paul Wilkinson, I mean, the reason the United States has chosen Guantanamo Bay and Bagram Air Force Base and Diego Garcia as places to keep some of their people is precisely because they don't want to give them the rights that would allow them to send out letters, such as Lee's talking about, isn't it?
Well, that's right. But I think that in the case of the capture of bin Laden, it would be a tremendous blow against terrorism if you could bring him to justice and the world could see the evidence against him, and the evidence, of course, is overwhelming. And I think that that would be a very important contribution in the longer term to the battle against terrorism. And I think we should be using the criminal justice system as much as possible, and perhaps it would be more beneficial in the case of all those against whom the United States believes it has evidence of involvement in terrorism, because undoubtedly holding people without the right to trial, without the right to defend themselves, becomes a propaganda weapon for the terrorists. And they are indeed already using that weapon, as you know, in their videotapes, in their messages to mosques and so on.
Right.
And so I think we have to look at the battle for hearts and minds. You know, this tends to be overlooked. But Scott was touching on it a moment ago when we were talking about Afghanistan. He pointed out it isn't only the fate of the top leaders you have to worry about. And I agree with him. It is winning the battle for the minds of the young Muslims who have been lured into this movement and trained to carry out these terrible attacks. And unless we begin to succeed at winning that battle for their support and weaning them away from support from extremism and terrorism, we will have a terrible problem of terrorism for decades ahead.
Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Steve's on the line. Hello, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm calling to comment that in terms of future attacks, long-term my concern is our follow-up in the war in Iraq, not particularly the war itself. I feel that it would give us an opportunity to have a more coherent foreign policy in the region, and if we take advantage of that and promote a two-state solution in Palestine and liberalization in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, then that would be the most secure way long-term to prevent attacks.
I'm wondering, Steve, if the United States was seen to be attacking Iraq in an unjustified manner, whether or not any form of nation building coming after that would take that sting away. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's obviously that concern, but we have our own domestic security that we have to worry about. And I'm very concerned about having Iraq in place, being able to give weapons to terrorists in the future. I think that's a valid argument, and I do have a concern that I mean, these are smart and determined people. I think it's only a matter of time if that regime stands, and if it doesn't stand, then it gives us an opportunity that we can take advantage of that we would not have otherwise.
Steve, let's turn to Scott Baldoff on the point that you're making, that, you know, about the way that attitudes can change. Scott, I don't know whether or not what you see in Pakistan, what you see in Afghanistan in your recent reporting trips gives you any insight here. Can the frustration over an American attack be turned with what comes after that?
You would see a change in attitude if there were a noticeable change in the way of life of the average Pakistani, and certainly of the average Afghan as well. You know, ultimately people are people, right? And so that if you were to see, for instance, that most Muslims in Afghanistan were able to practice their religion and were able to practice their culture to the extent that they wished, then it would eat away at this notion or this perception that America is trying to supplant that culture with its own. Same thing in Pakistan. But mind you, there is a lot of frustration over a number of issues: economic, social. There's the perception that their lives are being controlled by outside, not by themselves. And as long as that persists, there's going to be a frustration aimed at the world superpower.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for that call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Paul Wilkinson, when we look back in history, is there anything that gives us an example or of an idea of what Steve was talking about, that despite whatever frustration may come from one particular political or military act, that the attitudes of the people can be changed?
I think that there is some evidence that the attitude of people can be changed. For example, in Japan after World War II, in Germany after World War II. But the circumstances there were somewhat different. Both countries had at least a brief, limited experience of parliamentary systems, of democratic models of the kind that are familiar to us in the West. And therefore, the cultural leap that has to be made in any attempt to introduce democracy into the Middle East is a much more difficult leap. And I think we mustn't be too optimistic that we can simply plant a Western-style democracy into Iraq and then hope it will become overnight a kind of shining model to other countries. It would be marvelous if that could happen. But we have to remember that it has a great history of ethnic and religious conflict. Turkey is particularly concerned about the possibility of a Kurdish breakaway, a state of Kurdistan, which might threaten its own territorial integrity. There is the problem.
Let me stop you if I can, because we're a little short on time, and I did want to get back to the question that I'd ask you.
Yeah,
and I sort of have to ask you for a brief answer to this, though, about how the investigation for into al-Qaeda has changed with the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
I think it has moved forward by a substantial degree, and I think that there is no doubt that the intelligence services are closing in on bin Laden and his immediate entourage. One of the problems has been, of course, that the situation in the Afghan border and on the Pakistan side of the border has been very fluid, and the terrain is so difficult. But I think that they have now got a better idea where the leader and his entourage are hiding, and I'm hopeful that they will be able to track him down and bring him to justice, which would be a tremendous achievement.
Scott Baldoff, let me just hear briefly from you before the end of the program. I know that your address is in Delhi, but you've been spending more time in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Are you going to stay there for the short-term future, see what happens in the hunt for bin Laden?
Well, I think you do have to stick around for a little while at least, but there have been so many leads that have cropped up. And remember that the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed came after months of investigation after the capture of another top person. So the next shoot may drop in another 6 months. We just don't know.
Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor on the line from Islamabad in Pakistan. Paul Wilkinson, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Paul is director and chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University. Earlier in the program, we had a chance to talk with Shakir Hussain. He is a freelance columnist based in Karachi. To continue the conversation, please visit our forums. We are at www.theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR, coming up.